Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start with the latest from a partially shut down D.C. We'll then talk to the head of a union representing furloughed employees. Then we'll get your thoughts on day two. Then they didn't make the final two, but they left their mark anyway. Boston City Councilor Felix Arroyo and former head of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, John Barros, look back at their campaigns, why a person of color didn't make the final, then look to the future for Connolly and Walsh.
Editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGroy, is here on the government shutdown and a really upsetting sideline to the Boston Marathon bombing story. Then Jared Bowen. He'll be here to give us all the latest on new movies, including Enough Said with James Gandolfini, Rush, Prisoners, and Gravity. All that's coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey.
So the nation is in the throes of day two of the partial federal government shutdown. National parks are closed. More than 800,000 employees have been furloughed. And as you know, the panda cam at the National Zoo has gone, well, a lot of people are into that, has gone dark. Joining us on the line from the place where this all originates is the unshutdown Todd Zwillick. He's a D.C. correspondent for The Takeaway. Todd, good to talk to you again.
Hey, guys. Good to be with you.
Hi, Todd. I get the feeling, just on day two here, that this could go on for quite some time. Any indication today that that's a wrong perception?
Well, long time I can't say. There's no indication that there's a deal afoot. There certainly is not. Right now, what we're stuck in right now is the mode of a government shutdown that is all photo ops and preening. And that's to be expected. Well, it's true. You know, a government shutdown from the Washington perspective is primarily a political event. And so what you're seeing today are members of Congress rushing off to national monuments to be photographed next to hapless vets who can't visit their memorials, you know, sort of running behind the flag and reporters dutifully running after to photograph these things. Here in the Capitol, there's a bunch of messaging votes that are going on as House Republicans try to find a way to increase pressure on Senate Democrats to loosen their grip around the procedure here and shake something loose on individual funding bills. Today they're going to vote on funding Veterans Affairs, funding NIH, you know, some of the more sympathetic parts of the government, but not a continuing resolution to fund the whole thing. Of course, Harry Reid is refusing to do that and just kind of sitting, folding his hands. Although here's a little bit of news. The president has invited and the leaders have accepted a meeting for 5:30 today at the White House, McConnell, Boehner, Pelosi, Reid, to try to have a discussion. Nobody knows yet if that's an offer or an actual negotiation or preening by the president to make it look like he is negotiating by getting all of those leaders photographed walking into his office. We don't know yet.
Unfortunately, they can't get in the White House because all the security guards have been furloughed. You know, one interesting, so when you mentioned the preening standing next to veterans, next to monuments they can't get into, one of the great moments yesterday was when the World War II veterans, some in wheelchairs, actually broke through the barricades to see the World War II monument. Hey, you know, speaking of how imminent a settlement is, as a layperson on the outside, Todd Zwillick, my sense is if the tougher nut to crack, the debt ceiling, is only 15 days away, why would there ever be a settlement, particularly on the part of the Democrats, when they know they may have to go through the exact same thing with higher stakes just 2 weeks from now? It seems to me that at least that long is how long we're going to be doing this.
My gosh, Jim, you should be here covering this place because that's some insight right there. Once this shutdown started, everybody started running around saying, how long does this go? Because the further the shutdown goes, it becomes one big ball of oh, my God, for a negotiation. Now, Democrats, including Senator Dick Durbin, made points yesterday in gaggles with reporters to say, oh, no, this is all one thing now. Well, he would say that because Democrats want it to be one thing because that's one negotiation. And if they feel they have the upper hand on the government shutdown, which they do feel like they do, that's all to their advantage. Republicans want it to be two separate things. They want two separate negotiations because if they think they're going to extract some concessions on one or either of these things, the government shutdown or the debt limit breach, they want to get two cracks at it. If it becomes one big negotiation and there's a great deal of pressure, by the way, many Republicans, especially here in the Senate, have a private understanding that a debt limit breach just isn't possible, that it's really, in the end, not an island to stand on and not a negotiating tactic that's really going to work, because they don't want to be – not only do they not want to be politically responsible for a debt limit breach, they actually don't want to do it. A government shutdown, you know, like I said, is inconvenient, but primarily a political event that you can win or lose in front of the cameras. Debt limit breach isn't like that. So Republicans want to keep these two things separate. They want to get something on the government shutdown if they can. They would love to get something on the debt limit, but many recognize that might not be possible. Democrats, you're right, would love for this to be one great big thing.
One last thing for me. When you say the Republicans, and I did the same thing, I read this morning that so far there are 12 Republican House members, Todd Zwillick, who have said they would vote for a clean continuing resolution, and translated in English, meaning not tying it to delay of Obamacare or the repeal of the medical device tax. Is that a stable number, or is that growing hour by hour? Is the sense that some moderate Republicans are going to break ranks and join the Democrats?
Yeah, there's been a little bit of drip, drip, drip on this, and that's part of the dynamic here. There have been one or two Republicans coming out each day and saying they would vote for a clean CR, continuing resolution, i.e. spending bill.
Right.
Look, saying you would and actually doing it are two different things, and saying you would and getting the chance to do it are two different things. It's not the Senate where anybody can offer an amendment if they gather up the votes. John Boehner has control of the floor, and it's not just a question. Look, we already know the dynamic here. We already know that if Speaker Boehner put the clean continuing resolution on the floor, that it would pass. That's not in question. Everybody knows that. The question is how many Republicans would go along, what, 100, 110, and then you turn to Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer for the rest? That dynamic already exists. The procedure that 12 or 13 or 17 members in this case needed to undermine Boehner in this case to get it on the floor outside of his influence is arcane. It's possible. It takes a week. You can't do it right away. So there you go. It doesn't really. Yes, there is a drip, drip, drip. There might be some political pressure there, but it doesn't really change anything.
Hey, thanks,
Todd.
Hey, Todd,
thank you very much for joining us.
Anytime, guys. I'll be here for this whole thing.
Yeah,
so call me again.
I bet you will. Embedded right down there, Todd. Todd Zwillick is a D.C. correspondent for The Takeaway. And as always, great to hear from you, Todd.
In a couple of minutes, we're actually going to speak to a woman who is a leader of a union that represents federal government employees in New England. We'll get the sense of what the furloughed employees are doing on day two. But now it's your turn at 877-301-8970. Everything is on the floor. One, what are your thoughts on day two? Two, any creative suggestions how to break the logjam? I have one creative suggestion, Marjorie, and I'd love your thoughts on 877-301-8970. You know what I learned yesterday?
What'd you learn?
There was a government shutdown in Australia in 1975. Mm-hmm. You know how that was resolved? Very similar to this.
Is that the one the Queen fired everybody?
The Queen fired the Prime Minister. The Queen of England fired the Prime Minister and ordered the new Prime Minister to fire the entire Parliament, which he did, after which there was an election. If there was a national referendum right now, Marjorie, if there was a national referendum which said, we don't want to hear how you love your own congressperson and hate Congress, but you can vote up or down to replace the whole 535 members of Congress, what do you think the vote would be?
I think people would like to get rid of them all. They're absolutely disgusted. And I think that the fact that so much of this is predicated on people getting reelected is yet another reason for term limits, which you won't agree to. And there was also a great point made by Tom Friedman in the New York Times this morning,
what did he say?
Which I hadn't thought of. This is undermining majority rule. You know, you have a majority of people here to want to move ahead, and you have this small band of Tea Partiers that say, we're not going. And they are a small band. There's no sense.
Well, but the moderate Republicans, as they're called, are standing with them, so they do have a majority in the House. I mean, even though it's being led by a non-majority of Tea Partiers.
But you have a majority of people who have voted for a president that wanted Obamacare, the chief proponent of Obamacare, and you have this small group of outlaws somebody wrote today, I think it was Maureen Dowd, she said that John Boehner has become U.S. Senator Ted Cruz's sock puppet.
877-301-8970. And speaking of public anger, one of the things that a bunch of Congress people have done, according to the Washington Post this morning, have said they're not going to take pay if federal employees are not going to take pay and people are denying service. As of this morning, the only two Congress people from New England who have taken that pledge were Nikki Tsongas from Massachusetts and Congressperson Langevin from Rhode Island. 877-301-8970. What do you think on day two? Do you have a solution in store. And if you want to talk about the Obamacare sign up on day two, we can do that too.
Yeah, let's take a call from Jerry in Webster. Hi, Jerry.
It's actually Gary.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Yeah, hi. I'm fine.
Good.
I'd like to say that the current state of affairs with our inactive Congress is probably the most cogent argument for a parliamentary system where they either get the job done or they're thrown out and a new government is formed. And it's even more disheartening in the sense that you have a small, almost minuscule contingent of the lunatic right fringe that is tying this entire government up in knots.
Well, speaking of parliamentary, as I asked Marjorie a minute ago, if you had an opportunity, a variation on a theme, to replace all 535 with one vote, would you vote yes?
In a nanosecond.
Yeah, I think you're not alone. Gary, thanks for the call.
Well, you know,
welcome.
The thing is, the people that small little group of people that say, and I get it, that they were elected to go to Washington and be defiant and to get rid of Obamacare, they're being rewarded back home in their district for this kind of behavior. This is what their constituents say that they want. We all know
Want government shut down want Obamacare defunded? I don't think they want government shut down, Marjorie.
I think in some of these little gerrymandered districts, I think they absolutely do. I mean, we haven't had the poll nationwide, district by district, to see. There's a lot of support in these districts, which is why that gerrymandering is so dangerous to the rest of the country. And the other thing is, I think a lot of the moderate Republicans are worried that if they don't, they'll get a Tea Party opponent against them in their next primary, and they'll be out of office.
You should explain what gerrymandering is, by the way, for those who don't get
it. You arrange a district so that, for example, a lot of Republican districts have become, even though we're increasingly minority country, that a lot of Republican districts have become whiter and whiter around the country, even as the country itself becomes more of a mixed country.
But we should say it's two-sided. In Massachusetts, which is overwhelmingly Democratic, when the Democratic legislature every 10 years resets the districts, they generally do it in a fashion that makes it least likely that a Republican can win any
well,
of the nine
true.
Seats.
That's so true, but I don't think that the Massachusetts delegation is holding up Obamacare, so it's a little different situation. Let's go to Tom in Rhode Island. What do you think, Tom?
Hi. I just wanted to add perhaps another dimension. This tactic of the Republicans, I think it's a sign of desperation because rather than following the democratic procedure to change the law, which is to win a majority in the Senate, I don't think they believe they can do that. And so this is the only way they may see to actually try to exert enough pressure to change the law, which they dislike so much.
I'm sorry, but, you know, when you look back at 1995, I heard Newt Gingrich the other night, who obviously was the speaker during the last shutdown, saying, no, this wasn't a disaster for Republicans at all. And if you actually look at congressional outcomes, which relates a little bit to what you were talking about, Tom, in 1996, It was not a landslide away from Republicans. What was a landslide was the presidential election where Bill Clinton, who was the main adversary, for lack of a better expression, Newt Gingrich, won in a huge margin, obviously, against Bob Dole. And a lot of people attribute that to anger, lingering anger at the Republicans over the shutdown. Tom, thanks for the call. Yeah, thank you.
Just got a great email from Stephen who says, in place of government shutdown, I would be in favor of a government shut up, as in no public statements by any of these elected officials until the government is up and running. And you know what else I'd like? I'd like them all to stop taking their salary. Let every single one of them, because
about three dozen now who are in that margin.
They shouldn't get a dime. $174,000 mm-hmm. is not a lot of money if you got three or four kids and you have an expensive mortgage.
Well, you have two houses
kind of
for the most part, too. Two
That's
residences.
Right. So, you know, I mean, I think that could be an incentive to get things going if people are running out of cash. I think our Secretary of State, well, he's no longer the United States Senator. John Kerry, but he could afford, I suppose, to go a couple of weeks without a salary.
He could fund the whole Congress if he likes.
Have Teresa to help him out to get the groceries if things get tight.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking to you about your thoughts on day two of a shutdown that appears to have no end immediately in sight. We're going to get back to your calls in about a minute or two, but first, joining us in line is Carolyn Fedoroff. Carolyn is the Vice President of the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 3258, which has furloughed people amongst its members in New England. Carolyn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Hey, Carolyn, so what is happening with your workers? How many of them are facing these furloughs? What's happening?
Well, 95% of HUD employees are furloughed. We have about 97% of EPA employees are on furlough. We have a lot of employees at the VA continue to work, our VA nurses, our VA doctors and orderlies. However, they have no promise that they'll be paid, and regardless, they certainly won't be paid on time at this rate. So we have all of our members are affected one way or another.
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up, Kyle. I want to get back to what your work, your members actually do that they're not doing right now. But let's, since you brought up the pay issue, the conventional wisdom is, we were speaking to CNN's John King yesterday. He said, listen, though, it's 110%. They're going to get the money retroactively. There are a lot of people who think that that's not the case in these tighter fiscal times. How are people who live paycheck to paycheck, even if they do get the money back in a week or a month, how are your people getting through what promises to be maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks, maybe more of no check coming in the mail?
I'm sure they're borrowing on credit cards and they're, you know, calling up their friends and relatives. They're calling up their mortgage companies and saying, you know, I'm so sorry, I'm not going to be able to make the payment this month. I mean, for employees at the Department of Housing and Urban Development and EPA and Department of Defense, they had anywhere from 5 to 6 days unpaid over this past summer.
As part of the sequester or what?
As part of sequestration, yeah. Correct. And they have just started getting back to full paychecks. And once again, they're getting slammed with this shutdown.
We're talking with Carolyn Federer, Vice President of the American Federation of Government Employees. You know, I just mentioned that the congressmen are making about $174,000 a year. I don't imagine your employees are, for the most part, in six figures.
No. The average federal employee is earning about $40,000 a year. Our Border Patrol agents, our Bureau of Prison guards, these are not high-paid jobs, but they are really tough jobs.
Hey, Carolyn, briefly, if you can, of the people who are not working, I believe most of the Border Control people and prison people continue to work. But for those who don't, like you said, 95% of the people at HUD, a large percentage at EPA, give us a quick sense. What do they do that is not being done during this furlough period?
Well, a real quick point is they're not overseeing the expenditure of federal money. A lot of our money goes directly to cities, towns, public housing authorities. And our folks aren't there to provide assistance on what the rules or regulations are for that expenditure of funds. We're not issuing new grants. On the commercial side for HUD, we provide mortgage insurance. Mm. And on the single-family side of the house, we are doing the work that's currently in the pipeline, but we're not accepting any new work. On the multifamily side, which is four units or more, we're actually talking nursing homes and very large apartment complexes, we're not writing any new commitments on that side of the house. That's a big piece of business. I mean, the FHA insurance fund makes money.
Carolyn, we hope your people are back at work soon. Thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us.
Thank you. Anytime.
Carolyn is Vice President of the American Federation of Government Employees. So we're going to take your phone calls.
It is pathetic.
What you see, the average worker is making $40,000 a year. How long do you think you can go without pay when you're making $40,000 a year?
Especially if you don't know if you're ever getting it back.
And especially if you're a single person, you know, with a couple of kids. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What do you make of this government shutdown? You want to blame somebody? We'd love to hear who you're going to blame for this. And is it going to end in time?
And should we dissolve Parliament? I mean, I am wedded to this idea. I'm sorry. I wish the Queen had the power here.
Just ask
I'm not a big monarchist.
Because we've argued about this for years.
Yes.
What is your objection still? I mean, if they were not obsessed with getting reelected, we might have people actually vote their conscience and do the right thing.
That's
are
true.
You coming around at
oh,
all
the term
to my
limit thing?
Term limit idea?
No, public financing first, and if that doesn't work, then we can do term limits.
When are we going to public finance?
When are
think,
we getting
Jim?
Term limits?
I think term limits would be easier to get than public financing of elections.
8970.
Peter from Worcester, thank you for calling 89.7 WGBH. Hi, Peter.
Yeah, hi, Marjorie. I have two rants. And one is, I wish the Republicans would stop using the expression "the American people." This is what the American people want, and the American people don't want the Affordable Care Act. They overwhelmingly reelected Barack Obama
exactly
as President of the United States, and affirms their desire to have the Affordable Care Act. And I wish CNN would take Newt Gingrich off the air. He does not advance He does not advance the conversation whatsoever. He speaks untruthfully. He says President Obama is unwilling, totally unwilling, to discuss the budget, which is not true. The president is willing to discuss the budget. He's not willing to throw the Affordable Care Act under the bus. If Newt Gingrich is there for balance, he is he's wasting CNN's money.
Well, can I disagree with you, Peter, if I may? The reason why Gingrich has value, particularly right now, is Gingrich was one of the two players in the last shutdown 18 years ago. But the issue is if Gingrich is spinning something that doesn't comport with the facts, then it's the function of the host or the panelist or whomever to call him on it, and hopefully they will. Peter, thank you. Thank you kindly for the call. Where are we going?
Tracy and the Mass Pike. Hi, Tracy.
Hey.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello.
Yes, and even expanding on that, Newt Gingrich constantly says, as other Republicans do, that this is a job-killing bill, when in fact, healthcare jobs have been leading the creation, consistent creation, of private sector jobs for the for over 2.5-3 years. So there was considerable debate. The House voted, the Senate voted, it was upheld by the Constitution and the Supreme Court. It is the will of the people. And I think it's treasonous behavior of this small fringe group, because fiscally, this is outrageous. Knowingly defaulting, not defaulting, but lowering your credit rating when you're borrowing big money every day, money that's already been spent. I think it's treason.
Let me just say, Tracy, thank you for your call. In light of your call and the, I think it was Peter before you, while it is of course true that the embodiment of the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, was reelected in an electoral vote landslide over over Mitt Romney recently, the American public in every poll does not support Obamacare. However, you've all seen this poll after poll, day after day. Even if you oppose Obamacare, people in huge majorities oppose shutting down the government to defund Obamacare. So there, when you connect the two facts that are where we are now, the American people are not with the shutdown people, even if they happen to not be fans of the Affordable Care Act.
And you also think that a lot of this has to do with the Republicans, this small group that's holding everybody hostage, worrying that when enough people do get Obamacare, they may they may like Obamacare.
3 million people went online to healthcare.gov yesterday. 3 million. That's a lot of people on day
that's
one.
That's right. They were each on for 14 hours.
No, by the way, I went on yesterday. Let me just say I went on. And while it is true, I did. And I originally said Massachusetts, and then I forgot. Obviously, you go right to the connector site. But then I said Maine. I picked another state that I was from Maine. And while you are put on hold or whatever the equivalent is online, I timed it. 3 minutes and 30 seconds later, I was directed to the site. That's not a huge wait on the afternoon of the first day.
Well, of course, one of the reasons the site was crashing so much is because so many people were trying to get on it. Let's go to Ellen from Exeter. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I agree with term limits, and I agree with public-funded elections, because then really, really fair-minded, honest people could get into it and do their job.
Yeah.
But I got to say this. These people, they work for us, and they have forgotten that they are employed by us, the people of the United States of America. They are not supposed to do their will. They're supposed to do our will. And our will is that our government keeps on running. Our government is responsible and keeps on running. We need to fire them, and we need to start with honest people with term limits and public funding. And then we would have people would have a fair chance at getting into these elections. These people have forgotten who they work for because they're there to line their own pockets. Well, period.
You know. Ellen, you know what else, Ellen? Along the term limit lines, I mean, there's this incredible revolving door that Mark Leibovich, we had him on the radio a couple of weeks ago, has written this great book called "This Town." I think that's the title.
Yeah, about Washington.
Talking about the incestuous relationship between government employees and lobbying groups. And one of the things, a great argument for term limits, comes out of the idea that the longer you're there, the more time you had to have to schmooze and arrange for your next step into a $500,000 job on some K Street lobbying firm. If you're only there for 4 years or 6 years and you actually have to work for a while to work your way up and get to know the ropes, you may have less time to ingratiate yourself.
Yeah, and if you're only there for a few, Ellen, if I may, if you're only there for a few years, Marjorie, you're more beholden to lobbyists who have been there permanently because they understand the ways of the Congress far better than you do.
I don't buy that. There's a lot of staff people that stay there for a long time, too, that know the ins and outs and know what's going on. So, I mean, to me, you can't argue with anymore the notion that part of the reason our government is so dysfunctional is because re-election is the whole modus operandi.
You know, the old line.
Getting up in the morning, they're going to bed at night.
I have to ask you one more question. When you run some type of contest out of your radio station, not one of your family members can participate in that. It only can be people that are not associated
with it.
That's a great
point.
No lobbyist. If you are in the Congress in any way, you can never be a lobbyist, and nobody in your family can ever be a lobbyist.
Yeah. Ellen, thanks so much for your call and
Obama
your thoughts.
Obama was going to get rid of the lobbyists. It didn't quite work out that way, did it?
thank you so much for your calls. We're obviously going to stay on top of this in the days and hopefully not weeks ahead.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to be joined by City Councilor Felix Arroyo and John Barros, both gentlemen who didn't quite make it into the mayoral race, but we're going to get their take on the mayoral race, their future, what they want to see in the city of Boston. But first, stick around to find out what you can do to help keep WGBH programming on the air.
What if you could be the subject of a song? Singer-songwriter Jim Bianco has a questionnaire for that.
Like, one of the questions was, who was your first kiss? So I try to, like, use questions like that to capture experiences in life that everyone's had, the quintessential experiences in life.
Jim Bianco reinvents his songwriting formula today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Mass Eye and Ear, offering specialty services at more than a dozen locations in the Boston area, and now a new center in the Longwood Medical Area. Visit masseyeandear.org for more information. And Commonwealth School, an independent co-ed high school in Boston, cultivating intellectual passion, leadership, and connection with the city and the world. Open house Sunday, October 20th from 3 to 5 p.m. commschool.org.
I'm Susan Stamberg. In the early days of public broadcasting, the federal government provided the lion's share of funding for programs like Morning Edition, All Things Considered, PBS shows like Sesame Street. Well, times have changed. These days, the majority of money comes from individuals, foundations, and corporations who are passionate about the mission of stations like WGBH. Your support keeps Boston Public Radio available to the whole community. So please, call the station or make your contribution online at wgbhnews.org. And thank you.
The number is 888-897-9424. You can do your part online at wgbhnews.org. It's 89.7 sprints to the finish of our annual fall fundraiser. Hello there. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Brody with Marge Regan. We're joined now in studio by our buddy and colleague, WGBH's Edgar B. Herwick III. Hello, Edgar.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie. And hello to you. We are speaking with you, asking you to get involved in this community campaign on this. We're sort of sprinting toward the finish line here, and we need you to get involved right now. It is day two of the government shutdown, as we all know. And you just heard Susan Stamberg saying that in the old days, a federal government shutdown might have meant the shutdown of public radio, but not anymore, because most of our funding here, especially on the local side, comes from you. 70% of our operating budget for local stuff, which is what Jim and Marjorie are, that comes from you. It comes from people digging into their pockets when they don't have to, making a contribution. We're asking you to do that. We want to hear from 30 people during the show today. Just 30 people. We know there are many more than 30 listening. So if you're one of those 30 that are going to heed the call, do it right now. You can make a contribution on the phone at 888-897-9424. Or if you're listening online, right there. It's really easy at wgbhnews.org. Just make a contribution.
This Saturday night at 8, WGBH Television will air the world premiere of Elton John in concert. There's the songs.
Perfect
Tiny
cue,
Dancer,
Marjorie.
Benny and the Jets, Rocket Man, tracks off Elton's latest album, Diving Board, which is surprisingly really good. We just heard it yesterday. Become a sustainer with a gift of $12 a month right now, and Sir Elton will say thanks with a copy of both the DVD and the CD. WGBH, by the way, the only place to get a DVD of the concert and the new CD. Plus, you'll be entered to win two tickets to see Sir Elton live at the TD Garden.
Yes.
I know. Wouldn't it be great to see him? I mean, he still sounds terrific. 888-897-9424 or become a sustainer online at wgbhnews.org.
888-897-9424 is the number if you want to call. WGBHnews.org if you want to do it online. It's just as easy to do there. As you heard Jim and Marjorie saying, great Elton John tickets on the table. You'll be entered to potentially win two tickets to see the man, Sir Elton John himself.
Since you asked, Edgar, actually you didn't, but I'm going to do it anyway. Let's do a quick walkthrough of how easy it is to give online. Actually, you did bring up online, so now I'll fill you in.
Go ahead.
First, you go to WGBHnews.org.
You might already be there.
Maybe you are, maybe you're not. You can be. Second, click the orange donate button. It's on the right-hand side. Third, choose whether you want to make a single gift or become a sustainer. And fourth, you fill out the super simple online contribution form, and it really is quite simple. A more connected community in four easy steps. Really, what could be easier or better than that? Here's that web address one more time. Please do it now, really. WGBHnews.org.
Okay, Jim and I and Edgar here from the Curiosity Desk are really counting on you guys because every dollar you give will help programs like this one and Edgar's Curiosity Shop stay in the air and keep you and your community connected to the news and each other. Well, it's important. The Curiosity Shop.
That's where you belong.
No, what is it called? Curiosity Desk.
Thank you.
Whatever you want to call it, Marjorie,
Whatever it is. The curious want to listen in to Edgar at the desk or the shop or wherever he is. So a gift of any amount, you'll automatically be entered to win the two tickets right up to Elton John's only Boston show at the TD Garden on November 12th. Sorry, I said Curiosity
Shop.
It's okay,
Marjorie.
888-897-9424 or get involved online at WGBHnews.org.
Hi, I'm Ben from Amherst, New Hampshire, and I'm a sustainer of WGBH because it allows me to feel as though I haven't completely checked out politically. Great programming. It's easy to support. It's well-spent money because it comes back to you. It's not for-profit news. You're supporting a nonprofit, you know, ethical organization that is really community-driven, and ultimately, you know, your dollars go into you hearing a really good story.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 are two people among 12, or let's say maybe 11, who made the mayoral race something Bostonians can be proud of, Felix Arroyo and John Barros. They join us for their take on how the race went, what direction they'd like to see the race between Connolly and Walsh go, and the direction that one of these two finalists will take the city in. Felix Arroyo is a Boston city councilor. Hello, councilor. How are you?
Hi, thanks for having me.
John Barros, co-founder of Restaurante Cesare. Did I pronounce it right?
That's pretty good, Jim.
Still not there, but I'm going. A Cape Verdean restaurant in Dorchester. He's the former executive director of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. Thanks for joining us, gentlemen.
Thank you both for being here. So we're going to start in the backward direction for a minute, looking back at the election. You guys both did well. Felix, you were fifth, and John, you were close behind him at sixth, very close together. How come you're not in the final, Felix? We'll start with you, Felix. How come you didn't make it all the way?
You know, the beautiful thing about our democracy, voters make these decisions. You know, you go out there, you bring your message out, and you do the very best you can. And, you know, the voters decided to go in another way, and I totally respect, the decisions they made. And I'm just grateful that I was a part of it. I really enjoyed myself. And the ideas around ending poverty and moving families out of poverty and closing the achievement gap and ensuring everyone has a voice in a direction of the city, I believe, still are issues that Bostonians care about. And looking forward to working with the two finalists in hopes that they would speak to those
issues. So nothing you're looking back on, think, if I'd only done this, if I'd only done that?
I have no regrets. Okay. I went in with my eyes wide open. I knew I wasn't going to raise a lot of money. I recognize the role that money plays in politics. I don't like it, but I recognize it. But I knew I wasn't going to, so I really have no regrets. And I really enjoyed myself in the campaign and feel very good about the campaign we ran.
How about you, John?
You know, we had a strategy based on a higher turnout model. It didn't happen. Folks didn't come out. You had the super voters decide the election, and the super voters didn't vote for John Barros. But John didn't think the super voters were going to vote for him anyways, necessarily.
What are super voters?
Yeah, those are the people who vote in every election.
Right? Oh, okay.
And they came out and vote, and they don't look like John's base. They don't look like the voters that John targeted and spent all his little bit of money on making sure they came out.
And those people are lower income people, people of color. That's is that what you're talking
about? That's right.
Yeah. Why didn't they turn out? They had six candidates of color, a record. Right. Obviously, you know that as well as not better than we. I would argue five of them pretty competent people. You two amongst them. Why didn't they show up at the polls when they had a chance to make history?
That's a good question. I think we're going to be asking that question for a while. I've been asking that question, and you know, I get little anecdotal stories from different people why they didn't come out, and we've got to do a better job of turning them out. I don't think we spent enough time trying to turn people out. We were having other conversations that we shouldn't be having.
You know, there was a lot of play given, most of it critically, gentlemen, about a meeting that was called amongst leaders in the communities of color about whether or not any of the six of you should drop out to try to help the others. When it happened, Felix Arroyo, here's what you said. I truly believe that if someone wants to run for office, they should. One of the wonderful things about this country we live in, we can freely elect our leaders. John Barros, you said we should be in expansion mode. We should not be narrowing the field. Starting with you, Felix, any regrets that a deal, and I don't mean a deal in a pejorative way, but a deal was not cut where somebody would drop out and endorse another candidate of color?
No. And John's right. I'm a super voter, and I didn't vote for him. I'm really sorry. You know, you're starting to make me feel a little bad about it, but no regrets.
Well, why? Why do you say it was such a – people can't see your face. You say it with – not quite with disgust.
Because I have a great radio face.
No, but why do you say that, Felix? No. I mean, it's almost like, of course – why would – you know, I interviewed I mentioned this to John Barros the other night. I interviewed State Rep Russell Holmes when he was thinking of running for the state Senate seat, South Boston, Dorchester, et cetera. And he said he was announcing in a couple of days. And at the end, with a smile on his face, he said, however, if Linda Dorsina Forey decides to get in, we're going to sit down and talk and try to see who's the best candidate. So it isn't like it's some unprincipled act. It's been done through the ages. Why such a reaction to something that a lot of people think is a common sense thing?
I opened the interview by telling you I have no regrets, and that includes staying in the race. I mean, I quite frankly and have no regrets about the campaign we ran and staying in this race. And you know, voters make these decisions. You have to trust the voters, and voters make these decisions. You know, my only regret is that I didn't make the final two. But
Felix, I'm sure that's John's regret. We had that conversation. We had the early conversation when we were considering running.
Is it the two of you?
Yeah, the two of us.
This could be a
moment. Are you friends, the two of you?
Yeah, we're friends. Okay. And we're closer
even better
now.
Friends now,
right.
Actually.
What was that conversation like, John Barros?
Well, the conversation was trying to figure out, you know, can we both run? Does it make sense? Who's running? You know, and frankly, we came out of that conversation saying we should both run. You know, and Felix was really clear on his conviction and why he thought he should run and why he was running. I was pretty clear on mine, but we thought we had enough space for both of us to run. And what we really failed on in this election was turnout.
You know, what I would say too is when John called, and it's funny, I didn't think I had not thought about it till recently, but, you know, I had already announced that I was running. And John, as very gentleman act, called and said he's still thinking about it. And I told him privately what I tell you publicly. I said, if you want to run and if you believe that you have something to offer the city of Boston, do it, right? Like, this is – so many people come to this country from countries where you can't just run for office, where you can't just vote for who you want to vote for, where you can't just stand on a corner and say, hey, I have ideas, vote for me. That's what makes this country great. I know a lot of those people, and I am not going to participate in anything that would make someone feel bad about voting. They should feel great about voting.
Well, you're a nicer guy than I am. We're talking to Felix Arroyo, city councilor, and John Barros.
Well, you're not a guy at all.
I'm not a guy. But you know, you were all in the running. You were in the running, Felix. You were in the running, John. Charlotte Goldrich was in the running. I'd be pretty mad at your fellow councilor, Charles Yancey, who had no chance and was running for city councilor and running for mayor, because you look at the numbers. And I know you guys looked at the numbers. You talked about turnout, John. On the other hand, there was, I think, among voters of color, there was like 30 or 30-some percent people voted. So the numbers, Peter Galzinas, my colleague at the Boston Herald, did a column on this. If some voters had gone from Goldrich to you, or they'd gone from John Barros to you, or some of those Charles Yancey voters hadn't, or Charles Clemens, who had no chance running either, there could have been a person of color as the mayor running, at least. So the numbers were there.
Marjorie, allow me to just put back just a little
bit.
I get the idea had XYZ dropped out, then that person, voters would have gone this way. That's not right. You know, plenty of white people voted for me.
Right.
Plenty of white people voted for me. Plenty of Asians. Plenty of Latinos. Plenty of blacks. Men, women, young, older, gay, straight, people who have religious faith, people who don't. The idea that that we're monolithic in that way, I think, is incorrect.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you know, there's a – I mean, we've talked about this nonstop since the marathon.
Mm-hmm.
Big crime problem that doesn't get the same attention in Mattapan, Dorchester, and Roxbury that it gets in the – you know, they break a window at Beacon Hill. The whole city comes to – when someone shoots out a window. So there's an issue there. It's just like in the governor's race. People talk about, well, if Juliette Kayyem runs and Martha Coakley is – they're both running – is the woman vote going to be split? I think it's a legitimate point. What do you think?
So I think, you know, there are two ways to look at this. One is through the candidate's lens. The other one's through the community lens, right? And we spent too much time looking at it in terms of, like, how many candidates. I can't believe the community of color, the black community, can't put forth one candidate. Well, folks, you know, 20 years later, the communities have evolved in Boston in a way where there is no the community of color, the leader of color. We actually have a space where there wasn't consensus. And this is it. There was not consensus in the beginning that we had a leader, a candidate that was going to bring all of the issues forward and represent the community. I think it's really a disservice to a really diverse community that's really dynamic with a lot of different views and policy positions to say that we can come up with one candidate who is going to represent all that.
Let me step back then. Rather than asking about your individual candidacies, let's talk about the fact that this is a majority minority city, obviously, and all of you have looked at the numbers, not just the numbers Marjorie talked about, Mel King 30 years ago, when we were only one third of color in the city of Boston. He gets 48,000 votes in a preliminary against Ray Flynn. Charlotte Guller-Ritchie, who we invited today, who was unable to come, was on my television show last night. I asked her, what does it say about a majority-minority city that the two finalists are two white guys? And here's what she said last night.
We still have our work cut out for us. You know, I think we do. I think that if the end game is about having a person of color be the next mayor of Boston, then there needs to be a conversation. And again, I would argue that it's not just conversation with people of color. It's conversation with people of all racial groups to say that that's a good, healthy thing.
Now, Felix Royo, Marjorie said you're a nicer guy than she is. You're not nicer than I am. So let me just start with that.
I've never been accused of being nicer than you.
You mentioned money a couple of minutes ago. Another piece of data that I think may help answer this question, then I want your response to what does it say about Boston in 2013. Every white candidate except Walczak raised more than every candidate of color, including the three of you. Is that one of the issues? And then get to the larger issue that I broached with Charlotte last night.
Yes.
Money is the issue.
That's one.
And is that because
one of the issues? Yeah. You know, the way you framed the question, I'm answering it affirmatively that is one of the issues. And maybe you don't raise a lot of money when you're talking about poverty and closing the achievement gap and everyone having voice and direction in the city. But I have no regrets. Does money matter? Yes. I early on, years ago, I remember supporting the Clean Elections Law because I would love to see money not play a role at all in politics.
So let's leave money. Let's get to the law. What does it say about Boston in 2013? Majority minority, no candidate of color makes the final two. Apart from your own candidacies, what's the statement there? Is there one? Charlotte Guller-Ritchie said we have to have conversations. We have to get together, not just communities of color, but others, intimating at least to me that there is a problem and needs addressing.
Sure. I would have loved to have seen a candidate of color make the final two. In fact, I voted for one. But there were some positives that we could take out of this race.
What are they?
The fact that you know, there were candidates of color in the race for mayor, running very credible campaigns. You know, that I think communities were excited. Did they come out the way we wanted them to come out? Of course not. If they did, you know, me and John will both be in the finals and having a, you're at a different interview right now. But it doesn't mean that excitement wasn't there. You know, I have a lot of stories of people who voted for the first time in their lives and voted for me. And I know that John Barrows has the same stories. And that's a great thing. And it takes time. And I'm willing to put in that work. You know, I don't know if you heard, I happen to be young. And
34. You are very young. You have a long time to run again.
You know, the kids
office.
I coach don't call me young, but that's fine. So, yeah. You know, but I have, you know, I'm committed to that, the idea of people being civically active and really voting in their own interest as far as a community and knowing that there are issues we care about. And I think that's going to happen now. You know, John Conley and Marty Walsh, here's one thing I do believe. The next mayor of Boston amongst those two, one of them will be the next mayor. And the one that will be is the one that does the best job of convincing all Bostonians that they represent them. And right now, based on how the vote happened in the primary, the middle of the city is where the undecideds live.
Yep.
And the middle of the city is the most diverse part of our city. The most diverse economically, by race, by gender,
so
by sexual orientation.
So they'll pick the winner is what you're saying.
I truly believe that. And they got to come to those to these communities where me and John spent an awful lot of time campaigning and talk about the issues important there. Talk about the 80% violent crime in three neighborhoods that you spoke about a little earlier, Marjorie. Talk about our failing schools in our neighborhoods. Talk about affordability issues. Talk about the economy. And that's what's going to win this race. And so, and I think not only win this race, based on what you've seen with Tom Menino, the way to stay in office as well is to continue to do work with these communities.
What about the what should the guys Walsh and Conley do about this police contract that's gaining a lot of attention now, because we're talking about a total about a 25% raise to police officers at a time when things are very difficult. You're in the city council. You're going to have to vote for this, Mr. Arroyo.
Arroyo just took his headphones off and he's ready to
leave. But we'll start with you, John Barros, because you're not on the city council. What should happen?
Well, yeah, I'm not on the city council, but you know, from where I sit,
do
I think
you want to be?
I think that contract sounds a little too rich for me.
Yeah.
At a time when we are getting less federal and state aid, at a time when we actually have things we should be investing in, we should be talking to the police about not having us pay that much money for a raise. No one's getting that kind of raise in that kind of short period of time.
And if they say no after you make that request, and it's a similar request to what Marty Walsh has said he would make, John Conley said he plans to vote no after doing some research, what should the city council do, John Barros?
Vote no.
Vote no.
Before you move off that, you think the cops should have to live in the city of Boston?
I do.
They don't right now.
They don't. Well, there's a 10-year, right? There's a 10-year period.
Yeah, you get...
You know, I think there should be two things. One is there should be a 5-year period before you can apply, where you've been living in the city of Boston, and then there should be some requirements for living in the city of Boston afterwards.
Felix Arroyo shaking his head up and down. So, Felix Arroyo,
I just
counsel,
hadn't thought
I'm
about
sorry.
That idea before the before you apply. It's just something that he brought up, and I hadn't thought about.
I just think it'd be nice if you lived in an area that did have high crime to have a couple of police officers on the block. I would feel.
Yeah, just a couple.
I would like that.
Frankly, growing up in Hyde Park, there's a lot of police officers when I grew up who lived in Hyde Park and. I felt very safe in those neighborhoods. The question, I do sit here as a city councilor, until the end of my term. I will be or could potentially be casting a vote unless there's a deal that gets cut here. And the role I would like to play is the same role I played in the firefighters contract, which was, there was a arbitrator's ruling. And I was one of three city councilors who sat in a room and helped renegotiate that deal to something.
You and Mike Ross, who was the
and
third?
And Sal Amatino.
Sal Amatino.
Not that I have to be one of those three, but I'm saying I think the council showed its worth that moment. That was one of the moments, and I want to do that again. Right now, I'm undecided on what my final vote will be, but mainly it's because I have not gone through this arbitrator's ruling. The council's going to hold hearings. I want to hear it out. I agree with the Bostonians who go, boy, that sounds rich.
Should you guys vote before people vote for mayor on November 5th? Because you technically, I don't think, have to. I think there's a 60-day window, which theoretically could get you past election day. Should you vote before?
I understand the question. I even get the political sort of drama and theater around it. The answer to that is no, if it stops the ability to get a real good deal done. We did it with the firefighters. The president is there, and I think as a council we should play that role again.
We should point out the reason people say it's rich is because the average pay for a police officer in Boston now is $110,000, which is not a... Not a bad salary.
But that's counting the detail on all the time, right?
Hey, John, I want to ask you both. Felix Arroyo said a minute ago what the issues are. He thinks that both Connolly and Walsh have to address to come out of this doing the right thing and being mayor. Same question to both of you. One, are you going to endorse? I don't think either of you have yet. And two, what do you have to hear? If the answer to that is yes, what do you have to hear Connolly or Walsh say to get your endorsement? Starting with you, John, then Felix, please.
Well, I've sat down with both John Connolly and Marty Walsh, and we've had preliminary conversations just to kind of better understand where they are today and where they stand on certain issues. And, you know, for me, it continues to be about the achievement gap. We need to make sure that every child in the city of Boston has a quality seat in a quality school. It also is about making sure that all of our neighborhoods are strong and healthy and make sure that people in those neighborhoods have opportunities to get living wage jobs and that they have the benefits that they need to take care of their parents. It also is about making sure that small businesses are thriving in the city and that they're thriving not only downtown but in our small neighborhoods in different pockets, right? And so it's the issues that I've been talking about. So making sure that government is inclusive and highly participatory. Now, we can all have a voice in city government. Boston is a beautiful place, but we're not all engaged.
But you are going to endorse at some point.
You know, I hope to endorse. We'll see. It's
are you
not
leaning
clear.
Either way yet or not?
No, I'm leaning forward here to my cup of tea.
Okay. Yeah. How about you, Felix? Are you going to endorse? And what's the what will do it for you?
Me and John have very similar. Man, maybe you shouldn't have ran.
I tell you, maybe we should have held that meeting, figured out
what a terrible phone call that was when I said go ahead. But no, me and John have very similar ideas around what Boston can look like and what we have to do to get there. And that's what's moving me. It is around the issues of poverty. 20%. This is very serious. We're a city of 630,000 residents. 20%. We're talking about over 100,000 people live in poverty in our city. 40% of Latino children, 35% of Black children, 1 in 3 of all Asians, 20% of the entire population.
Does the middle class care about poor people in 2013? When they're struggling, I don't mean this even in a critical way. When you're struggling to keep your head above water yourself, my thesis is not because you're bad people, not because one is a bad person, but your interest turns inward. You turn to yourself and your own survival,
sure,
and you have less concern. So there's, it's not.
I get why that happens. Yes, the middle class cares and should care. The stronger and larger middle class is, the better for all of us who consider ourselves middle class. And sort of economic history has taught us that. I'm a little bit of an economic development junkie. It's what I studied in school. But economic history has taught us that when the middle class has grown, it's been the strongest economic times for our country and for all of us. So yes, as to the question, those are the issues that move me. There's no different than what I campaigned on. I truly believe most Bostonians care about those issues.
So you will endorse at some point? You will pick one of these two guys publicly?
I'm very open to it, but I have to believe that the one that I'm standing next to, if I make that decision, will work on the issues that I just spoke about.
So what are you going to do in the future, John Barras? You may be the next head of the BRA.
Silence.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I have read that.
You've read that?
Yes, I have.
I guess I got to give John my resume.
He actually does have a surprise look on it. Is that a real look
David
of surprise?
David Bernstein, our own
GBH
unless I'm hallucinating, wrote that.
Is that right? So David should tell me then, who should I support to be the next BRA? I'm surprised. I would love to be the next head of the BRA, but no.
There it is. Boom. Right.
Thanks. Margie, why don't you broker that for me?
Okay.
But
make sure I'm right. Yes, it is. David Bernstein. John Barrow's stock is high, perhaps heading the BRA.
So what are you doing? Assuming you don't do that, what are you doing in the near future?
I am spending time with my little ones, to tell you the truth.
You just had a brand new one,
that's
right?
That's right. 14-day-old, right? And I am spending time with him, with my 17-month-old and my wife, and we're going to vacation.
Oh, good
that's
for you.
That's my next thing. And the Caribbean.
Now, John Barrows told us, Felix, he would give us a discount at the restaurant. What are you going to do for us?
I don't have a restaurant.
what
am I going to do? Felix, I'm going to go to the day you're getting a discount. I'm showing up.
Okay, post-city council come January, what's in the cards for Felix Arroyo?
I don't know yet. You know, and I'm frankly relishing the idea that this new chapter in my life is beginning and really looking forward to it. I'm not – I feel very – good about my 4 years on the city council, having passed the Invest in Boston bill and, work around libraries, and very grateful for the time. You know, it's a privilege that's soon going to end, but one that I won't forget. And I'm very grateful for Bostonians giving that opportunity. And I just want to keep working on the issues that I've talked about. And, I'm sure there'll be a place where I can find myself happy and working on the issues.
Yeah, one last question for me. I knew your dad, Felix Arroyo, different in middle initial, right?
Yeah,
so you're not a junior.
Yeah.
But a great guy, full of enthusiasm. You're a chip off the old block. You are a vision of enthusiasm. Where did you go to college?
Dartmouth. You're talking to John Barrows, right?
Yeah. Yes.
The reason I ask is because,
John's dad?
The reason I'm asking it this way is because I could see how you ended up in city politics. But you went to a hoity-toity college. Lots of people went on there, Masters of the Universe and all that. And you came back to the neighborhood. Why'd you do that, John Barrows? You could have gone a million different directions.
In fact, the first 4 years of my life, I worked at a corporation. Chubb Group Insurance Company, made a lot of money, sent me to New York. We had a good time on Wall Street. But the organization that I first got involved with at the age of 14, the Dudley Shoe Neighborhood Initiative, at the core of its mission is the belief that residents, people who live in the neighborhood, particularly those who are most effective, should be the leaders in trying to reclaim and revitalize that neighborhood. And I believe in that wholeheartedly. And I couldn't believe that I was going to be nurtured by that agency, by those organizations, by the organizations that I was involved in, by the people in that neighborhood, and not come back and give back. And that's something that I always knew I was going to do, and I was really happy to come back and serve as executive director.
Hey, John Barros, City Councilor Felix Arroyo, thanks so much for your time. Good luck in the future. We hope neither of you are strangers here on Boston Public Radio. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
When we come back, it's time for Open Mic with Brian McGrory, who's going to talk about the government shutdown and a really startling story related to the marathon bombing. But first, we're going to find out how we can keep conversations like this on the airwaves on Boston Public Radio.
This is 89.7 WGBH, your home for public radio.
From NPR News.
For more than 40 years.
This is All Things Considered.
Every afternoon.
The news of today.
When you're in the car driving home.
Please support it at WGBHnews.org.
Money and happiness. How closely are they intertwined? I'm Kara Miller. This week on Innovation Hub, how turning down money could increase your happiness. Thursday night at 9 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Sullivan Tire and Auto Service, with over 100 master technicians on staff offering brand name tires and parts, committed to serving New England for over 56 years. Information and locations at sullivantire.com. And the Cure Alzheimer's Fund, presenting a free symposium in Boston on Wednesday, October 9th, where researchers will gather to discuss new information on research toward finding a cure. More at curealz.org/symposium.
Oh, you know, I talk about GBH all the time, my friends. Hi, I'm Sue from Londonderry, New Hampshire, and I'm a WGBH sustainer, GBH journalist. Really bring the human aspect to these daily news. Well, you can always get the facts, but it doesn't always mean anything or it doesn't stick with you. But I find the GBH journalists, they kind of present the gray areas and bring out, you know, personal parts of stories. So I wanted to kind of make sure I continue to listen to those and become a sustainer, do my part to help GBH continue their wonderful reporting.
And you can do it online at WGBH.org or call 888-897-9424. Good afternoon. I am Jim Browdy. Marjorie Egan is here. And it's good that you're here because it's 89.7's annual fall fundraiser, and we could really, really use your help. With more, here from WGBH, most of us call it the Curiosity Desk. Marjorie calls it the Curiosity Shop, apparently.
Or whatever words pop into her head.
Edgar
at that
B. Herwick III. Hi, like wherever you're from, we're glad you're here, Edgar.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here, too. So we were just talking about the mayor race. Get this. A person who was born the same year that Mayor Menino took office is now old enough to vote.
I know. I love that.
How good is that, right? So the mayor's race was a big deal here. And this is one of the places on this radio station and this show in particular where it got a lot of attention. Every candidate was through these doors, as you're hearing now. Now that we're into the final two, we're still talking with candidates who didn't make the final two. We'll be talking with the candidates who did. Look, this does not happen without your support. It's very, very, very simple. If you want Jim and Marjorie on the air, if you believe in this, then we're asking you to stand up and be one of the people that help pay for it. This does not happen without your support. If you like Jim and Marjorie, if you like this kind of local coverage, make a phone call right now to 888-897-9424. Or if you're online at WGBHnews.org, you can make a contribution there. Look, whatever amount works for you, that's what works for us. Just do your part.
And a special thanks to a few people here who apparently do like us, and we're very glad you do. Emily in Warwick, Rhode Island. We've heard from a very, very generous listener in Stowe. We've heard from Arlington, Margaret in Norfolk. We're looking for just 13 more people who also like us.
And you can help this afternoon, this very afternoon. I promise it'll make a big difference. Your support is what keeps news, stories, good conversation going right here in our community. Remember, right now during Boston Public Radio, a gift in absolutely any amount will get you in on the drawing to score two seats right up front to Elton John's only Boston show. It's at the TD Garden on November 12th. All you have to do is call 888-897-9424 or get involved by clicking that orange donate button. It's at WGBHnews.org.
This is 89.7 WGBH.
In this house, a good laugh is always appreciated.
I'm calling from Ridgecrest. Mojave Desert.
Mojave Desert. And what do you do there?
I look for work.
Atta girl.
And every now and then, so is a good cry.
He had brain cancer, and I went up to him, and I'm like, I know you're scared, but you gotta believe that you can make it.
This is WGBH, your home for public radio. Please support it.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marge Regan. He joins us every Wednesday on Open Mic. He's the editor of the Boston Globe. Welcome, Brian McGorry.
Hello, Jim Browdy. Hello, Marge Regan.
Hey, Brian, how are you? Good to talk to you, as always. So, Brian, I know you weren't down in Washington until right after the last shutdown when you were White House correspondent, but I find this whole situation so depressing. What do you make of the shutdown?
It's ridiculous. I mean, it really is. Forgive me for using this as a chance to tout some of our work over here, but, you know, that's my native state.
Okay.
We've had the series throughout the year called Broken City,
yes.
The dysfunction that exists in Washington right now. And this is kind of the ultimate manifestation of all that's gone wrong down there. And the idea that hundreds of thousands of people are not drawing a paycheck this week, federal workers, because Congress can't come to terms and do what Congresses have done for 200 years, which is fund the government, is patently absurd.
By the way, as of this morning, the Washington Post ran a list of members of Congress who are not taking their paychecks. And at least as of first thing this morning, the only member of the Massachusetts delegation who has said she's not getting paid is Nikki Tsongas. Back to what you said a minute ago, refresh my memory. That great series you did do, what was the story of the Minnesota Congress? Was it Minnesota congressperson who was a young member of Congress? He went back into the real world and then he returned. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
yes, that was a great one.
Name. It was his nickname is Rip Van Winkle.
Right, and what was that about again? I
night
was terrific.
And day is yeah. What it was about. He couldn't believe how it had changed.
It was exactly as you said, Jim. He was a young congressman and he went... He was in Congress and he did very well, and then he stepped out to go into the private sector for a while, and then he was encouraged to run again. And he went back to Washington, and the Washington he returned to, I forget whether it was last year or 3 years ago, he said is a completely different place than what he had known before, a place where Republicans and Democrats no longer speak, where compromise is never reached, where partisanship is the way of the day, and where nothing of any great meaning seems to get done anymore. I mean, we also, you know, in the same spirit, we had one on a Kansas congressman, member of the Tea Party, came in the Tea Party surge a couple of years ago, and he was unapologetic in telling us, telling Matt Visor, who was out there, that his constituents sent him to Washington to be disruptive, and they sent him to Washington to end Obamacare, and this is what he would do. It didn't matter if, you know, whatever votes he had to take, he was not there to compromise with Democrats, and it's not what his constituents expected him to do.
Well, Brian McGorry, you do hear that same sentiment from several of these Tea Party people in the wake of this shutdown, which, of course, makes you get nervous, at least makes me get very nervous. You know, we reached the debt ceiling October 17th. That's only, you know, a few days away. We may not be able to compromise then.
And that, according to economists, is the one that's particularly problematic. We could end up in a government-induced recession if Congress can't get its act together here.
By the way, I assume you saw my television show last night, Brian. Did you?
It was brilliant.
Here's the issue, Jim, and yeah. I apologize. I only saw it live this time. I didn't get a chance to watch it on tape like I usually do.
So you can break it down a little bit more.
Replay my favorite Jim Browdy moment. So if I'm not as well-versed as I usually am, forgive me.
Okay, well, I did a poll that everybody has heard about yesterday, which I thought was perfect. Quinnipiac did a poll of Americans, and 47% to 45%, they oppose Obamacare. So by a slim margin, they oppose it. They asked those same people who oppose Obamacare if they wanted it defunded. The answer by about 20 points was no. And then they asked them if they wanted it defunded, if the cost of defunding was shutting down the government. And the answer, 70-something to 27-something, was no. So when the Tea Partiers, who are being loyal to their constituents, say we were sent here to shut down Obamacare, that may be true, but they were not sent there to shut down the federal government. In any case, on a related note, we took some criticism in email yesterday in the last 24 hours, Brian, from people who – we had a conversation with a woman who is a health reporter and contributing editor for the Columbia Journalism Review. And we were talking about the Obamacare websites, healthcare.org.gov, pardon me, and which in Massachusetts, at least, switches you to the connector, because obviously we're in a different situation. The criticism we took was, we were saying, it's so incredibly complicated. It's really hard to maneuver. It's difficult enough to be able to choose between phone companies, but the thought of choosing between healthcare plans when your family's health is in the balance. We got a lot of people saying you're exaggerating, you're being critical, you're whatever. Have any of your people attempted to either sign up or at least maneuver the websites to get a sense of what real people are facing?
Not that I know of, and it's a really good point. We should absolutely try that, because when you put the government in charge of handling something like that's already inherently complex, like health insurance, I can't even imagine what it must look like. Obviously, you've seen it, so you can. But that's a really good story.
Kayla Czar used to work for the Boston Herald, has a very good story today talking about the hundreds of Mass residents who did attempt to sign up, and there were some glitches, and they went to the connector to get help and stuff like that. So they did cover it.
But we're in a slightly different – I mean, the 3 million people went online. And by the way, I didn't just mean the complexity of the site, and I attempted to do it yesterday. It's also what I said to this Trudy Liebman, I hope I got her name right, from the Columbia Journalism Review yesterday, was that there's such an emotional component to making that decision that even if the government did it perfectly, it's still a borderline impossible task for people who care about their loved ones, that sort of thing. In any case, so
Brian, you guys had a story this morning that just sent me through the roof about Ibrahim Todashev's girlfriend being in custody again, at least according to the civil rights group down there. They say, and she's the one, she's 19 years old, and she had been, you know, visa had been, she was overextended, she was threatened with deportation, then she got out. Then she talked apparently to a journalist from Boston Magazine and then to one of your people. And the FBI, at least according to the civil rights group, brought her back into custody and told her, you've been talking to reporters saying this Ibrahim character was a good guy. We're arresting you and holding you in the county jail. Now, if this is true, I mean, it's like, the Gestapo. I can't believe that this is going on in the United States of America.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. And we are looking into this. We did have a story today on it. We're looking into it more deeper here. It is outrageous. And then you compound this with the idea that we have had still precious, precious little information about what happened in that apartment when Todashev was killed. And this case is actually particularly confounding. I'm not it's tough to get your head around, but we are looking into it.
We should mention, we just discussed this with the Attorney General yesterday. We'll actually play her soundbite in a second. But for those who don't, the name is familiar but don't know all the details. He's the guy who was killed in his apartment by an FBI guy. Conflicting stories about what he was doing before he was shot. And he allegedly was about to sign a confession implicating him and the older Tsarnaev brother in the unsolved triple murder on 9/11/11 in Waltham. And as of the moment, no FBI report. The FBI ordered the coroner in Florida not to release the autopsy. Yesterday, Brian, because we discussed it with you, we asked the Attorney General, why had she rejected the request of the Civil Liberties Union to investigate it herself in light of the fact there were two Massachusetts state troopers?
Oh, that's a key
who were at least
fact
part
right
of the
there
thing.
There were two troopers in the apartment.
Yeah. Here's what she had to, here's what Martha Coakley had to say.
Well, I didn't refuse to do it. I simply don't have the authority or jurisdiction. Let me just say this, Jim. If that had happened when I was DA, and DAs do the investigations around homicide, if we had that happen in Middlesex County when I was DA, I would have done that investigation. So I was glad to hear that the Florida District Attorney, who does have jurisdiction and the ability to review that, said he is undertaking that investigation.
Can I give the Boston Globe another assignment in addition to the earlier one?
How? I'm here writing it down, Jim. Go ahead. I'm writing it all down.
If it turns out, and again, Martha Coakley knows the law 1,000 times better than I ever will, if there are two Massachusetts state troopers who are on our payroll, taxpayers funding, they're in this thing when this thing happens, how can the chief law enforcement official of the state not have the jurisdiction to investigate? I don't get it at all.
Yeah, I would think that minimally she could investigate from that angle about what these troopers were doing there, what they saw, what they knew, what they didn't know. And I would think there's something to be done there. But again, I don't know the law like she knows the law. I would also think that she would have the ability to put some pressure on federal and state authorities down in Florida because we are intimately involved up here in Massachusetts. This was about a triple murder case up here in Waltham, and we need answers up here. We just plain need them. This isn't how this country works. People don't die in their own apartment with federal authorities having fired the weapon and not provide answers as to what happened there. It's inexplicable.
Well, let me make a statement that is maybe borderline irresponsible as to why it matters so much that you might not be in a position to make or might not even agree with. It's not just solving a triple murder of three people who had families. We actually interviewed the sister of one of the people who was killed, Eric Weissman, a couple of weeks ago. But it seems to me that it's quite obvious that if we learn about the confession and what Todashev was saying, we may draw a conclusion that law enforcement officials should have been able to get to Tsarnaev sometime after the triple murder if he was in fact involved. And by definition, if they got to him then, there might not have been a marathon bombing on April 15th of this year. I mean, that's just the facts.
Yeah, I mean, look, maybe not. You're extrapolating quite a bit from there. I'd just like to see this investigation continue and get some information on the public realm so we can figure out whether that kind of thing is true or not.
Well, you know, he was killed on May 22nd. It's now October 2nd. Obviously, they know what happened. They're just not telling us what happened. I mean, there have been all these conflicting reports, as everybody knows. This young man, Todashev, was armed. Then he wasn't armed. Then he was armed. And, you know, different reports on who was there and how many people were there and stuff. And now you have ICE, which is supposed to be in charge of immigration and naturalization, again, according to the civil rights group that you guys have in the paper this morning, ICE saying because she talked to a reporter, we're throwing her in jail. I guess I don't understand why people don't get upset about this unbelievable power of the federal government. It's really scary. It's part of the reason people are scared of Obamacare, too. It's the same link of this overreaching federal government, although I am in favor of Obamacare. But you know what I mean? That people who are powerless and like this woman who's an immigrant from another country are just put in jail.
Mind-boggling. From start to finish, I've never seen anything quite like this case here. I mean, we did have a story done by our terrific immigration reporter, Maria Sacchetti, a while back, showing how the FBI has handled other cases in which somebody has died at the hands of an FBI agent, and they were much more public than this one. This one seems to be an outlier, and it's an outrageous outlier.
Well, and not only, and then I'll put the exclamation point on Maria Sacchetti's story, as you've mentioned before, and then a former Globe reporter, is it Charlie Savage is his name, for the New York Times, did a piece showing that out of 150 shootings, some of which led to deaths by the FBI with suspects being questioned, 150 out of 150, they cleared themselves. So one would suggest we need something else. In any case, Brian, moving on here, your name came up a couple of days ago on this show when we were talking about the mayoral candidates. And I want to play something for you because I think it's pretty clear now that despite the best efforts of Marjorie Egan and you were when you were a columnist, these words were uttered not so long ago.
The car is no longer king in Boston.
Now, as you know, Brian, that is the outgoing mayor talking about, I think it was Hubway introduced a couple of years ago. We wanted to get your thoughts. There's now a future bike plan. Derek Jackson wrote about it the other day in your paper. The number of commuter trips by bicycle in Boston, 2%. They hope in 30 years to get it up to 30 to 50%. The number of bike lanes will theoretically grow from 120 in the city to 364, tripling. So are you warming up to this or no?
First of all, why do you do this to me?
Are you warming up to this?
Why do you do this to me? Let's take a look at what the Globe has done in the last few weeks on this issue.
Yes.
We sent our terrific transportation reporter, Martine Powers, to the Netherlands, who came back with a really, really insightful story over how they do bike lanes in what is probably the most successful bicycling country on Earth.
That's right.
And
There was a key word there, Brian, segregated from traffic.
She wrote in detail about how they put hard barriers up that protect cyclists and keep them separated from automobiles, and had some real ideas for what we could do here in Boston and greater Boston. And I think that bicycling is great. I have always said that, always. Jim, don't contradict me here.
I'm not saying anything. I'm just listening.
The problem is in a city like Boston, on roads as narrow as we have here, with drivers who have the habits we have, and cyclists who have the habits they have, of keeping everybody safe. And what we saw in the Netherlands was a pretty good blueprint for how we might do that here.
And you forgot to mention what you said last time we brought this up. We mentioned Martine Power's great two-part series that she traveled coach. Is that correct? No, you just for those who are watching the budget, she traveled coach.
That's the problem. That's the problem. Even in this new bike proposal that Derek Jackson is written about and other people have written about, we're only talking about half of the roads allowing that separation.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, you know
what
should happen, and I'm probably not supposed to say this stuff in the role I am in now, but you know what should happen here?
What?
So many of these cyclists are up at our big universities, and what we should have is Boston University, Northeastern University, should get together and figure out a pilot program of what they can do with the many miles of bike lanes they have on their campuses and around their campuses, invest university money to keep their students safe, their student cyclists safe, and provide a clear path, pardon the pun, for what the rest of Boston can do in terms of bicycle safety here. And it can start all around the Northeastern campus, all around the BU campus. They would look good. It's a good study in sociology. It's a good study in transportation. It's a good study in urban engineering. And that would be a blueprint for the rest of the city.
Why it's a doubly good idea is both the two finalists, Walsh and Connolly, have made clear to us and anybody else who's asked that they are very pro-cycling in the city. And when they negotiate these payments in lieu of taxation, because as everybody knows, universities like Northeastern or BU are very wealthy but tax-exempt, property tax-exempt, they can include that in their pilot payments. Their payments in lieu of taxation could direct some of the money to this bike thing. I think it's a great idea. Hey, one last thing on the mayoral front. Are you worried about the Globe is a pro-civility in politics kind of newspaper? In the preliminary, I thought was very civil, and I think people on your editorial page wrote the same thing. Day one, when Connolly and Walsh went back and forth on the People's Pledge, Marty Walsh said, quote, "I don't trust him," meaning John Connolly, "on this issue." Now they're fighting over the police thing. Do we have the potential for this to degenerate into a typically sort of low road political campaign in your estimate? I'm serious. I don't mean
Jim is rooting for that.
No, I admire both the guys, but is that a fear after the first week of this? Or
yeah, I mean, it's not a fear. It's these campaigns take the course that they're going to take. I mean, we're not going to be Miss Manners over here. You know, if the candidates end up going at each other, then that's what they do. We would like to think that when they go at each other, we'll be about issues. Look at it. We're not going to sit here and preach that everybody's got to be nice and hold hands at debates and sing kumbaya. It's you know, it's a political campaign, and this is Boston. Let's see where it goes.
Speaking of this is Boston, Brian, John King was with us yesterday from CNN, and he ended by saying that at 3:05 on Friday, he will be in a field box on the first base line for the first game, either against the Indians or the Tampa Bay Rays. Where were your seats? Where will your seats be, Brian?
I think my seat is going to be a window seat at Morrissey Boulevard, looking out at the Southeast Expressway, while I try to put out a Saturday and Sunday paper.
Raise your right hand when you say you're not going to the game on Friday.
Jim, you're breaking up. I can't keep breaking up here.
Well, since I'm breaking up, now this will aggravate you a little bit, but it's the end, so you can be aggravated, then you can go. So let's assume the Cleveland Indians make it, okay? Hello?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who's the manager of the Cleveland Indians?
It's Terry Francona.
Who wrote a book with Terry Francona? Who wrote a great book with a best-selling book, Dan Shaughnessy? And in the book, I'm sure you read it. We read it. It was great. Dan's a friend of ours and obviously an employee of yours.
Fantastic book. New York Times bestseller, as it were.
It was. Terry Francona was a little critical of Red Sox ownership. So do you have a water cooler or something at the Globe? Do you have any of those kind of things or a coffee shop? What do you do there?
We work really hard over here.
Is there been any discussion about what Shaughnessy's first column will be like if Francona comes to town?
There has not been discussion. What there is discussion of over here constantly, and discussion I like to lead, is that we are blessed here with a world-class sports columnist, one of the best in the country, and Dan Shaughnessy.
He is.
And we're also blessed with a world-class new incoming owner who has very high hopes and expectations and ambitions for the Globe. All of these people can live together and work together wonderfully because they're all so talented.
Brian, that was an exquisite answer.
It was.
Thank you.
It was beautiful.
When's that? I mean, we asked you last week. What's your sense of timetable here? Do you know?
Timetable on what?
Oh, on this deal being closed, the Henry ownership being closed.
Everybody has always said publicly sometime in October, so I think they're still shooting for October. The Post deal, the Washington Post deal with Bezos, I think closed this week, didn't it? They got that done pretty quickly, but I think everybody, it's complicated when you are basically extracting one company from another, which is the Globe from the New York Times. Yeah. And you've got to make sure all sorts of things like payroll and insurance and all that are done right, but it appears that it'll be this month.
You know, the starkest example, before we let you go, of the new era of ownership, the Jeff Bezos, the John Henrys, that sort of thing. Yesterday there was a story, I don't know if it was in the Washington Post, and if people don't know, obviously he's the new owner of the Washington Post. There was a picture of him holding up the old Kindle and the new Kindle, which obviously is an Amazon product, which is, he's saying now, is in competition with the iPad. Did you see the photo? It's so weird to see people, I don't mean this critically at all, I mean it observationally, in two worlds. I mean, he's selling Kindle and marketing Amazon, this wildly successful company. At the same time, he's the new owner of the esteemed Washington Post. A little odd, isn't it?
I would disagree with you there, Jim, because maybe I'm just drunk on the Kool-Aid in business now, but we are, in essence, newspapers around the country, we are turning into technology companies in no small regard. Yeah. I mean, we are, you know, we've got two websites, we've got multiple apps, we've got, you know, e-readers, we've got iPad presentations, we've got all of this stuff. And if a newspaper is going to succeed in this era, we have to be a technology company as much as we're anything else.
Agree completely. Brian, good to talk
Brian,
to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. I hope you enjoy the baseball game on Friday.
Marjorie, Jim, thank you very much.
You're
Take
very
care.
Welcome.
Talk to you soon.
Brian McGrory joins us every Wednesday. He is, of course, editor of the Boston Globe. He comes in at 1 o'clock tomorrow, 1 o'clock. Join us for Open Mic with Christopher Lydon. And coming up, arts reporter Jared Bowen joins us for the latest on stage and screen. But first, here's how you can help keep the likes of Christopher Lydon and Brian McGrory on public radio.
As a community organizer and politician, Mel King's impact on Boston is ingrained into the history of our city.
When the people organize, get into the street, and are willing to challenge, then change happens.
I'm Adam Riley. Join me for a special conversation with Mel King, Sunday night at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
We love our contributors. That means you and Boston University's Executive MBA, Real Connections for the Real World. Online information session, October 9th at noon. More information at bu.edu/EMBA. And Earthflight, a nature special presentation. Take a breathtaking voyage on the wings of the world's birds. This week, explore Asia and Australia. Don't miss Earthflight, Wednesday at 8 on WGBH2.
Drop off the kids, buy groceries, get an oil change, pick up the kids, mow the lawn.
Whatever you have to do this week, thanks for taking Boston Public Radio along for the ride. So how about crossing another thing off your to-do list and keep all your favorites free and available here on 89.7 by signing on as a WGBH sustainer? You choose the amount, $10, $20, or $30 a month, whatever works for you. That amount will renew automatically, and that means one less thing for you to worry about. Become a sustainer by calling 888-897-9424 or give online at wgbhnews.org.
It is easy to do online at wgbhnews.org or with a quick call to 888-897-9424. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Marjorie Egan here with Jim Browdy, and you are listening to WGBH's Boston Public Radio during 89.7's annual fall fundraiser. And here with us in Studio 3 is Andy Hicks. Hello, Andy.
Hey, guys. Great to be back. The number to call, again, 888-897-9424. You know, I was just listening to the coverage you guys have been doing of the mayoral race and all the different changes that are happening here in Boston. 89.7 has always had Boston covered. We've got Philip Martin out in the field covering the Whitey Bulger trial a few months back. You guys talking Boston every single day, everything from the mayor elections to the music scene, and then stories that just make you feel good to be a Bostonian. if it's happening in Boston, you're going to hear about it here, and it's happening because of what you're going to do right now. When you pick up that phone, 888-897-9424, or make a gift in any amount, and it's really easy to do this online, too, at wgbhnews.org.
Can we agree that there's no exaggeration when you say that Elton John, excuse me, Sir Elton John, is a living legend? Mm-hmm. And when a living legend comes to our fair town, it's cause for a celebration. Well, on November 12th, Sir Elton is playing the TD Garden, and WGBH has your tickets. You support this station with a gift in any amount, and you'll be entered to win a pair of tickets to the show. All you have to do is one of two things. You either call 888-897-9424, or you can pitch in online at WGBHnews.org.
And I have some sincere thank yous and very sincere thank yous to Melanie from Worcester. We've heard from people in Westford. We need to hear from 9 more people before 2 o'clock, and we will reach our goal. So please pick up the phone.
That's right. Keep Jim and Marjorie on the air, available to you every single day. Someone from Westford called in. Thank you so much. It's my hometown, Westford, Mass. This is the fall fundraiser. We actually have a big goal. It's not really a money goal. It's a people goal. And it's about people really stepping up and doing what they can. We had 2,500 listeners to hear from last Thursday. Right now, we're down to, if I do the math really quickly here, Carrie, the one, we are down to about 1,020. That is fantastic. We'd still love to hear from you. Be number 1,100 and whatever I just said on the phones or online right now, because the point of the station is to be a local resource for people like you who live and work here. Whether you make that gift of $5, $50, we had someone pitch in with 1,200 earlier during this show alone. Whatever you can manage, it all matters. 888-897-9424 or WGBHnews.org.
What'd you get in math in high school, Andy?
I don't want to talk about
it. Okay, fine.
Now,
there's some great incentives to get involved right now. As I said, the exclusive DVD CD Elton John offer. Chance to win a pair of great seats. Catch Sir Elton live here in Boston when he plays the TD Garden on November 12th. But the reason, the real reason to get involved is because you like what you hear on 89.7. Because you depend on public radio to keep you informed and updated on days like this when real news hits. And you're appreciated being part of the conversation. Marjorie and I are not only on the station, we are big-time listeners of WGBH Radio. You can do your part with a call to 888-897-9424 or just click the orange donate button at WGBHnews.org.
This is WGBH, hey, the station that introduced America to Downton Abbey.
And tell Mr. Matthew he must wait his turn. He's seen the baby, and they haven't.
And if you're still reeling from last year, you won't believe what happens as the Granthams face the roaring 20s.
And I feel like a Chicago bootlegger.
I don't even know what that means, but it sounds almost as peculiar as you look.
Support 89.7 with a sustaining gift of $10 a month, and WGBH will say thanks with Downton Abbey Season 4. The hit show returns to Masterpiece on January 5th for its fourth incredible year. Just a few weeks later, you'll receive your copy of Downton Abbey on Blu-ray or DVD, before it's available in stores and well before the season finale on WGBH2. Call 888-897-9424 or secure your copy online at WGBHnews.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 to go over movie releases that are new and local theatrical productions is WGBH's arts reporter Jared Bone, is also the host of the TV show Open Studio. Jared, it is great to see you.
Good to see you guys.
Let's start with movies, Marjorie. Can we do that?
Yes, and I'm really psyched because some of these movies are absolutely fantastic. Actually, I've seen one of them, which is so rare for me. I'm always behind the eight ball on these kinds of things. But I have seen Enough Said, the James Gandolfini movie. What'd you think, Jared?
I loved it. Well, first of all, can I back up for a little second and say that this is a great time for movies right now? I mean, often we find that after the summer, they sort of dump the junky movies, and it takes a little while to get rolling again, and then you get the Oscar releases later in the fall. But right now, there's this plethora of really good movies, including Enough Said, which I loved. It's definitely a 4-star movie, as are a couple of the others that we'll talk about. But I just love this film because it's so well-written and so well-directed. Of course, it's a story of sort of middle-aged romance.
Yeah. You
know, after you've had your kids and you've had your divorce, and it's time to go on to the next stage of your life. And so we find Julia Louis-Dreyfus's masseuse falling in love with James Gandolfini. And isn't that great, that first date that they have?
Oh, yes. And they go out to dinner. Yeah, it doesn't seem to be going that well on the first date.
No, I mean, she can't hear, but she's distracted by his ear hair and his big paddle hands. And I think it was really written in some way for James Gandolfini after he signed on to the film. And, of course, it's even more touching because this, of course, is one of his last films. It's not the last film.
You know, I haven't seen it yet. I'm huge fans of both of those. But I say, I know this is ridiculous, so I shouldn't even say it. So why are you saying it, Jim? Well, I'm going to say it anyway.
It's not true.
I can see someone who just died in a drama. For some reason,
no,
I can't picture someone who just died in a romantic comedy. She doesn't agree with me. Obviously, you don't either, correct?
I completely don't agree with you. And for some reason, he has such life and spirit in this character because
then.
he's this great guy who he's in the same capacity.
Great guy.
Yeah, he's
you
just looking
him.
For love.
He's so warm and tender. And, you know, and she's also this masseuse, and it's so funny. She's dragging around. She's got this little car. Every place she goes, she opens the trunk. She pulls up this big masseuse table. And every massage she's giving, you know, some guy is either trying to nuzzle closer to her chest or he's making a pass at her, and some woman never shuts up. And then she lugs this masseuse table up about 27
huge,
steps
steep staircase.
To this guy
well,
that's about 22. Well, the thing it is that everyone will relate to is that people pick each other apart in relationships, you know, and they start complaining about the way the person empties the onions out of their guacamole when they're, you know, putting their little chip around the whole thing.
And this is in the film. This is not Marjorie making a confession here.
And you can relate to it whether you're married or not married or just, you know, with a new boyfriend or whatever.
Do we have a little sound from Enough Said, Julia Louis-Dreyfus and James Gandolfini? Here it is.
This is my daughter.
Wow, she's stunning. Here's mine.
She's beautiful.
I don't know what my life is going to be like with this whole going away to college thing. I guess we should develop hobbies.
Especially I weave.
Like baskets?
Yeah, I do it in the garage.
Really?
No.
We're all laughing. So A.O. Scott in his New York Times review said, in pretty, I thought hyperbolic, but apparently not, according to you two, Eva, meaning Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character, is like no other movie character I have ever seen. I mean, that's pretty... That's pretty
well,
big
very
talk,
real,
isn't
very
it?
Real.
Well, that's what he goes on. That's what Scott goes on to say, that she is totally real. You can imagine her as many of the divorced women you see in the world, I guess, is the point.
What this film does, I think, is it takes the shine off of relationships. And typically we see films about young relationships. I say this as Romeo and Juliet, another version is about to come out. But this film takes the shine off. And you, as Marjorie was saying before, you get a real perspective. So here you have this couple where there's really nothing to lose. I mean, what's going to happen on a first date when you're in your late 40s, early 50s, and you just realize you're not going to get the perfect specimen anymore. You're not going to get somebody who's that ideal package in every way. So you just kind of find the comfort, the basic comfort in finding just a really good person. But then outside influences do come in. She runs into Catherine Keener, who gives her some, I don't want to give too much away, but who gives her some perspective on who James Gandolfini might be. And it starts to cloud Julia Louis-Dreyfus's ideas. And like all of us, you suddenly find sort of outside forces infiltrating, and you see those little peccadilloes, which you just wish didn't drive you crazy, but it does interfere. But it's so real. It's not flashy. It's just a lovely scenes.
Yeah, everyone will relate to this. People that are still married for a long time will relate to this particularly as well.
Enough Said is that one. So let's go from romantic comedy to anything but romantic comedy, Prisoners with Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal. What's the story there, Jared?
Well, this is a tough film. I mean, from the very first scene where you get this color palette that stays with the film for the rest of the movie, which is all these heavy grays and browns. But basically what happens is Hugh Jackman and his wife are having Thanksgiving with another couple, and suddenly their daughters disappear. And what they've put together is there was an RV camper parked outside their home. Suddenly it's not there, and so the person who was driving the camper must have taken their daughters. He's later arrested. He's played to perfection by Paul Dano, who is in that movie There Will Be Blood, and he's just this creep. He's got this oily hair, the big 70s sunglasses, just such a disturbing, high-pitched voice, an incredibly disturbing individual. But the police, led by Detective Jake Gyllenhaal, can't hold him, so Hugh Jackman's father takes matters into his own hands, kidnaps Paul Dano, and basically holds him hostage. So it's this myriad of issues all in this one film. It forces you to examine your moral compass. Wouldn't you, as a father, go to any length to exact justice and try to find out where your daughter is? I mean, that's why he's holding him, to just get this one piece of information, because he believes that he does have the information It brings about issues of Guantanamo, even. And, I mean, there you think about Ariel Castro, even though the film was made after that. There are all of these things about society that come into play today. But most importantly, it really, this is a film that's so affecting because you think about what you would do and what sudden allowances you would make.
Let's hear a little bit from prisoners, if we can.
Show me your hands! Where'd you put those girls? Where are they?
What do you got?
We didn't find anything. This thing's clean.
That boy has never been in trouble a day in his life.
They're letting him go.
What?
The police said they're letting him go today.
Why aren't you sending someone out to go arrest this guy?
Well, he has the IQ of a 10-year-old.
There's no way he could abduct two girls and then make them disappear.
Maybe he wasn't on his own.
We're considering all possibilities.
I don't think you are considering all possibilities.
Just let me do my job.
4 days have passed since Anna Dover and Joy Burt were last seen by their families.
This is one I'll be passing up, I think.
I can't believe you said that, even though I can see the look on your face, Jed. You really like it. As a parent, I just can't handle these
movies about abductions.
Kidnap things.
It's really tough, and it's gruesome. And part of the reason it works so well for me, too, is that you see Hugh Jackman as you've never seen him before. And you must think that he brings some of his own personal life to bear because he is a father of, I believe, two children. And he has this ferocity and this seriousness and this severity that you've never seen him do in any other film. And I know he just got the Oscar nomination for Les Mis, but this is the far better performance. Not that they should be compared, but it is the best you've ever seen him.
Not a song and dance kind of role for Hugh Jackman.
Not really.
Of great performances, I'm still upset that Sandra Bullock won the Academy Award a couple of years ago, but I'm going to get over that because the movie, I can't stand science fiction movies, and I am looking forward to Gravity more than any movie this fall. You have a big smile, too.
I have a huge
tell
smile.
Everybody's seen the trailer. Marjorie saw the trailer about an hour ago.
Yeah.
Tell the story, Jared Bone.
So, well, here's the conundrum that I'm in, because I actually don't want to say too much, because this is a phenomenal film. It is so fantastic. There are moments in this film that you realize that you've probably gone 3 minutes without breathing. I mean, is that affecting? So I don't want to give too much away, but to say what you see in the trailer, which is Sandra Bullock plays this medical engineer, and she's working on the Hubble telescope with George Clooney. And suddenly this debris field develops, and I'm probably already saying too much.
No, it's in the trailer.
And she's cast off into space, as is he. And then for the next 90 minutes, there's every effort that she makes to get some sort of rescue for herself and ensure her safety in some capacity with George Clooney as well.
Yeah.
And this is masterful acting by Sandra Bullock, especially when you're aware of what she had to do for this film, which is they basically built this contraption. They called it a light box that she had to be in so that you could get all of the sense of her floating in space and that very fluid movement of her tumbling upside down or going through her own space station. The only way they could do it was to put her in this box. And when you think that she basically acted with nothing around her, wasn't really in space, it's incredible. And she does so much acting just with her face here.
You know, would you want to see this like in the IMAX theater?
It is a 3D. Is it a 3D?
It's a 3D film. And I say that I highly suggest you see this. And I hate 3D.
So
but should you do the whole nine yards and do the 3D in the IMAX if you can, if it's there? Would that matter?
You at least have to do the 3D part because I'm also somebody who my stomach doesn't survive
IMAX
very well.
I am the same exact way. Let's hear a little bit of Gravity. She can't breathe.
I can't breathe.
And Jared said you couldn't breathe.
I've seen it. I know how it ends, and I can't breathe
right now. I take it back. Don't go to the IMAX theater.
Oh, my God.
You won't be able to take it there.
And I've seen the visuals in the trailer. Just the sound is incredibly compelling.
We're talking with Jared Bowen about movies and theater. We're going to come back and talk to him about some more theater in just a second. But first, we're going to hear about why and how you can help keep Jared Bowen and all of us on the air here at WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Thank you.
Next time on The World, a sweet story from South Africa about a high school girl from a tin shack neighborhood and her big night out. It's the end of her school year in Cape Town, and she's been saving up for months to buy a dress for the prom.
You have to look good. You have to look the part. You have to just, you know, have that oomph and shine.
Prom night and the news next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you. An America's Test Kitchen Live with Christopher Kimball coming to Sanders Theater at Harvard University October 16th. You can get a lively look at the PBS program America's Test Kitchen. Info at boxoffice.harvard.edu. And the Museum of Science, where you can uncover a portal to ancient times at the new Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. See what life was really like over 2,000 years ago. More information at mos.org.
Hey, this is Edgar B. Herwick III. So if WGBH was a house, I think that the Curiosity Desk would be the attic. It would sort of be like the attic in Goonies, if you've ever seen that movie, you know, right? There's like a treasure map up there. There's some old photographs and newspaper clippings. You know, there's like scientific devices, mechanical devices. Maybe there's a telescope. You know, you take your time up there, you browse. And that's kind of what we try to do with the news and with stories. And when something's happening in the news with the Curiosity Desk, it's about looking at it for long enough that all of these surprises start happening.
So you call 888-897-9424. You can pitch in online at WGBHnews.org. I'm Jim Browdy with Marjorie Egan. You're listening to WGBH's Boston Public Radio at a very important time. It is our annual fall fundraiser, and that's when we rally support to keep programs like this one and others on the air. With more, here's our colleague at WGBH's Andy Hicks. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Jim. Marjorie, great to be here. And just great listening to – I love hearing Jared on the radio. I love the, you know, the arts reviews and everything, this sort of movie preview. These are all movies that I really want to see, especially Gravity. I mean, look, fantastic.
I'm so in the
Yeah.
I'm a nervous wreck just thinking about it.
Well, seriously, that looked really good. The Prisoners looked really good. I mean, the whole, you know, like he said, it's this whole kind of season full of movies. But if you tune in for the kind of storytelling you hear on public radio, you tune in for the local reporting you hear on Boston Public Radio, and you tune in for Jared Bowen's arts reviews, this is the time to make it all possible with a gift in any amount. 888-897-9424. WGBHnews.org. It's so easy to give online. And when you do, you can tell us why you listen. Say how much you love Jim and Marjorie, how much you love Jared. This is a really, really great time to get involved. And Marjorie is going to tell you why here.
Yeah, well, you can help reduce on-air fundraising, which, of course, no one really likes. Let's be honest here. You can reduce this.
I like it.
Well, okay, you
it's
like it,
job.
Andy.
And I like it.
But by becoming a WGBH sustainer with a gift of just $6 a month. $6 a month and 89.7 will say thanks with Diving Board, the latest CD from Elton John, his first solo album in 7 years. We heard it yesterday with Sarah Rodman from The Globe. It was fantastic, released just last week. It features 12 all-new tracks. So pick up your copy, support great entertainment here at WGBH at the same time, all when you become a sustainer for a gift of just $6 a month. Call 888-897-9424 or online at WGBHnews.org.
That's right, $6 a month as a sustainer, and you will be qualified for those two tickets to see Elton John November 12th at the TD Garden. This is a great opportunity and a great time to get involved.
And a lot of us, and I'm sure a lot of you, grew up with public broadcasting. Listen to this. Today's kids are growing up with it too. 7.1 million kids a week are learning to explore their world, ask questions, and experiment with Curious George. And when they get to school, this is unbelievable too, they might notice that Nova is the number one resource in science classrooms around America. And before long, they'll be the ones making a difference, and they might join the millions nationwide who get their news from NPR every single day.
So we're all guilty of putting things off, but I really hope you consider doing your part right now so you don't forget. It's our annual fall fundraiser, the time when we really support to keep programs like this one going strong. Plus, when you give right now, you'll be entered to win a pair of great seats right up in front to see Elton John when he plays the TD Garden on November 12th. So please take advantage of this offer, and more importantly, make an impact on your community. Call 888-897-9424 or just click the orange donate button on WGBHnews.org.
This is 89.7 WGBH. In this house, anything can happen.
We're joined by the governor of the Commonwealth for an hour of Ask the Governor. That's him from singing, but go take it. That was actually
that was
quite something.
Impressive.
Who what are you talking about?
And everything's on the table. It was the world's first burger grown in a laboratory using a cow's stem cells.
It's close to meat. It's not that juicy. I miss salt and pepper.
And no ketchup, Richard.
This is WGBH, your home for public radio. Please support it.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And since Andy Hicks, Marjorie says that he really likes Jared Bowen, we decided to keep him around for another segment. We did recent film releases, and now we're going to go to the theater, Jared Bowen.
Yes, we are. Tell us about Potted Potter.
Wait, first of all, can I just ask, why wasn't I invited to the Governor's Cabaret here? No, I would have happily come down and reviewed that show.
The guy can sing. He can sing a little bit. He's sung on our show a couple of times. He can sing.
Yeah, I know that because he does band in Boston every year.
Of course.
And he dances really well, too.
Is that true?
Does he?
He does, yeah. Every year he and First Lady Diane Patrick, they dance. It's beautiful.
You know what else he does? He dresses beautifully. You ever notice what great suits
and the ties? He's really good.
He's got great ties. She picks them out from what
and
I understand.
They had a press party at his house one time. And remember going to his house? He decorated it all himself. And it is impeccable. He's got a great eye as well.
So we're with fashion reporter Jared Bowen. Jared, let's get back to Potted Potter. I'm actually interested in this. Is this for kids and for adults or what's the deal?
It's absolutely for both. So it's basically the one sentence tagline is it's all 7 Harry Potter books in 70 minutes. And I happen to have read all 7
have
Harry
you?
Potter books. I have. I have nieces and a nephew, so I have to be well versed. And so you have these two guys who are really, really hilarious. Actually, they're former BBC hosts, and this all started because one of them was hired to entertain the huge lines that would line up outside bookstores in London.
Oh, that is great!
Waiting for the books, and so a 5-minute sketch has now turned into this 70-minute show, and they take you quite irreverently through all 7 books.
One at a time, serially. Is that how they do it, or is this
sort
all
of? They sort of bounce around, and there's actually a Quidditch match. Which happens if you don't know what Quidditch is. It's like, the big sporting event.
Flying around Harry, sporting
exactly,
thing.
Exactly, flying around in your broom, or in this case, a vacuum cleaner, which is one of the things they try to drag out.
That's great.
So it gives you a sense. It's really funny. It's completely irreverent. And actually, I have to say, one of the two men, Daniel Clarkson, reminded me of a male version of Rebel Wilson.
She is a
hilarious
she
blonde
is a
Australian.
Genius.
Yeah, and so it's very, very funny. It's very clever. They get the audience enthusiasm. I'm not a fan of audience participation.
Nor am I. It gives me hives. It does. But, yeah. But
well, imagine me, because I always am on the aisle because I have my press seats.
Yes.
And so I always see them coming, and I'm like, it's like moths to the flame. It happens to me every time. Get away from me. But this time it was okay.
Did you actually participate, or they passed your ball?
Well, I had to participate in the Quidditch match just a little bit by bouncing a ball through the audience.
At least you didn't have to climb on the vacuum cleaner.
No, or in unzip somebody's dress, which I had to do one time. And
really?
A play. Yeah, they had this, it was a Tennessee Williams play staged in one of the small hotels. They had 25 people, and the woman walks over to me and gestures to her dress. And I thought, I don't know what to do. It's in the middle of the play. And so I unzipped the dress, and I thought this could go horribly wrong if that's not what she was intending. But it was, yeah, she wanted
you
to
you took a chance?
I did.
When I lived in Greenwich Village many, many, many years ago when I was in law school, I went and saw a play that was sort of right after Hair. It was written by Shel Silverstein. It was all the performers were naked. And that was hard enough to take. But when the play is over, all the naked performers come out into the audience and talk to you. And you're supposed to have shake their hand and have a conversation as if you're just talking. Look at Marjorie. Just that way, in any case. So moving on from that, Tribes.
Well, surely you were just thinking about art. And
in that instance, I actually, you know what the key is? No eye contact. Yeah, that's the key. What's Tribes? What's with Tribes?
Tribes is presented by Speakeasy Stage Company. This is a really, really good play.
We didn't say Potted Potter is where? I'm sorry.
It's at the Paramount Theater right on Washington Street.
Through the 6th of October. My apologies. Back to Tribes. Thank you.
And Tribes is actually, it's so good that they've just extended it another week. So it's open now through October 19th. But you settle into this British family full of communicators in some way or another. The aspiring opera singer, the academic father who's a writer, the mother who's trying to write a detective novel sort of about the breakdown of her marriage. They're very smart people, but very acerbic and sardonic, and they yell at each other, and it's quite funny, and it quickly develops into this super fun comedy. But you know, they have all these ways of expressing themselves, and the one person who probably has the most to say but can't say anything is their deaf son. I mean, he can speak, but he's sort of been marginalized by the family because they don't want him defined by his disability, so they've never allowed him to learn sign language. He must participate in this family the way everybody else does, through reading lips and using his cochlear implant. And then suddenly he meets this girl who's losing her hearing. She was raised by deaf parents, so she brings him into the world of sign language, and suddenly his whole world opens up. And it's just – it's a really well-written play, and it's so well acted and presented here and directed, because it's in the round. So you feel like you're sort of immersed in this family. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I hate to say, maybe it's my own bias, but you perhaps sometimes think you're going into a piece like this like it's an after-school special or something. It's not. This is incredibly real and deals with the issue of deafness and family's interaction in a very true way.
You said it beautifully. Now, we only have 45 seconds left, but it's something that I actually saw. Marjorie is yet to see. I know it's sold out, but there is standing room. The great Bryan Cranston in The Great All the Way, the LBJ story from the day he takes over when Kennedy is assassinated till his re-election a year later, with civil rights in Vietnam in between. Give us your 30-second review.
My 30-second review, first of all, it was flowered by the fact that Doris Kearns Goodwin was sitting behind me, so I enjoyed her laugh.
That's pretty good.
Comments.
Oh,
so
that
was pretty
is great.
Good.
Who wrote the book about LBJ?
Yeah, of course, and who worked with him. I thought it was largely good, but too long. They need to take out about 20 minutes because it gets a little too dense, but it is mesmerizing, I thought, to watch Bryan Cranston play LBJ.
Can I tell you, I think everything is too long except that. I loved every minute, every interaction with LBJ, and if you can do the standing room thing, or it's going to go to Broadway, obviously, is it not?
They haven't confirmed it yet, and I hear it's actually a little bit iffy, but
oh, really?
I would venture to say it probably will.
It was great. Jared you were
Bowen.
Great, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Jared Bowen is WGBH's arts reporter and host of the TV show Open Studio. Jared, thanks again for joining us. Before I wrap up the show, we're not going to do that. We're not going to tell you how you can help out. We're just going to go. So I am Marjorie Egan, and I want to thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio.
You know what we are going to do? I think we are going to tell people in a second how they can help out.
Oh,
what do you think?
We are going to tell people in a second.
Yeah, because I actually like doing that, Marjorie. So we're going to do it in a second. What's coming up tomorrow quickly?
What's coming up tomorrow is Christopher Lydon is going to be here at 1 o'clock to talk about, on the eve of the 50th anniversary of JFK, JFK.
This is 89.7 WGBH. In this house, we ask a lot of questions.
How does a mayor end the cycle of poverty?
How would you fix the team?
So what should Red Sox fans be concerned about at this point?
And explore a ton of new ideas.
An environmentally friendly battery made from wood.
The revolution will not be televised, but could it be tweeted?
And so I think in 10 or 15 years, nothing is going to be the same.
This is WGBH, your home for public radio. Please
support
it.
It's written, apparently, so that you can do it.
Yeah.
888-897-9424. Good afternoon. I'm producer Andy Hicks here with Marjorie Egan. Just a couple more minutes left during the show today, asking you to be one of the last three people to check in with your gift of support online at WGBHnews.org or at 888-897-9424.
You know, one of the best reasons to give some money here is because you feel really good about it. You feel like after you've done it, because I have done it, you're participating, and you're not feel like you're stealing stuff without participating. So it's the annual fall fundraiser, and being a fundraiser, obviously, the money means a lot, but the most important thing can't be measured in dollars. It's you guys from this community coming together, keeping programs like this on the air, participating in keeping them on the air. You can help do that right now with a gift in any amount, and when you do, in addition to any thank you gift you choose, you'll also qualify to win. And he's been talking about them all day, these two great seats to Elton John's upcoming show at the TD Garden on November 12th. So 888-897-9424. Click the orange donate button. Feel really good when you do it at WGBHnews.org.
Hey, Marjorie, could you thank a couple of people here who just checked in, actually? How about you do it?
Absolutely.
You sound better than me.
Oh, with huge, huge thanks to Nita. Is it Nita?
Nita
in West Wareham. Thank you, Nita. Gail in Linfield. Carol in Salem. Thanks to all you guys who donated today, and thanks you for listening to us on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I'm Marjorie Egan. Thanks for tuning in, and please tune in again tomorrow.